From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For Christmas Eve, we have an interview with the great singer Tony Bennett. And we'll play his recording of White Christmas, maybe one of the best versions ever recorded. How does an atheist teetotaler without children spend Christmas Eve? We'll call Penn Jillette and find out. He's half of the music and comedy team, Penn and Teller. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the Disney Studios' latest animated feature, Beauty and the Beast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Russian Federation informed the United Nations today that it will take over the Security Council seat held by the Soviet Union. Yuli Vorontsov, the former Soviet ambassador, said that he presented his credentials as the new Russian ambassador to UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. Vorontsov said that the secretary accepted his credentials verbally. It's not clear whether a UN vote will be necessary on the change of representation. The Commonwealth of Independent States authorized Russia to take the Soviet seat at its meeting last week. Christmas Eve fighting continues in Croatia despite attempts at a holiday truce. Kathy Jenkins is in the eastern Croatian city of Osijek and has this report.
Driving into Osijek at dusk on Christmas Eve was to enter a town still trapped in the misery of war. The sound of rockets and shells burst out at intervals, some outgoing, some incoming. Many people who have stayed on in Osijek are spending their Christmas Eve in the same air raid shelter where they've spent every night for the past few months. Underground in this converted shopping center, a sense of Christmas has crept in. In one dormitory, home for dozens of people, a few tables are laid with Christmas food. Paper chains and tinsel decorate the roof. The hospital in Osijek reported that 5 people were injured in attacks during the day. For the first time in months, a mass has been held in the cathedral today. But with the situation as it is, the next service will be held underground. For National Public Radio, this is Kathy Jenkins in Osijek.
Another body has been recovered from floodwaters in Texas, bringing the death toll to 15. 2 people are still missing, including a baby, after torrential rains flooded parts of the state over the weekend. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
Floodwaters are receding today in north, central, and west Texas after last week's rain left many cities under several feet of water. Residents in those areas are spending the Christmas holiday assessing damage. Several hundred homes have suffered severe flood damage or been destroyed, not counting those that still aren't accessible due to high water. Texas Governor Ann Richards is asking President Bush today for federal disaster assistance for at least 4 counties. Residents in southeast Texas are now bracing for the worst as floodwaters head downstream. Voluntary evacuations have been called for people along the lower Trinity, Brazos, and Guadalupe rivers. In Houston, searchers are still looking for a man who fell into a swollen bayou Saturday. And in West Texas, a baby is missing in floodwaters. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 28 points to finish the day at 3,051. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-1 in heavy trading of 162 million shares. This is NPR News. Swiss police say they've arrested an Iranian they believe is implicated in the assassination of former Iranian Prime Minister Shapur Bakhtiar. Bakhtiar was murdered in early August at his home outside Paris. A Swiss Justice Ministry spokesman said that the arrested man was staying at the Iranian embassy in Bern, although he was not an embassy employee. France has 18 days to make a formal request to extradite the man. Shapur Bakhtiar was 76 at the time of his murder. He was the last prime minister of the Shah of Iran and went into exile after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. A body believed to be that of Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins arrived today at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. Higgins was kidnapped by Muslim extremists in February of 1988 and later killed in captivity. Jill Wolf reports.
A forensic medical team faces a grim task over the Christmas holiday, that of identifying remains flown in from Lebanon. Officials in Lebanon made a preliminary ID that remains found in the street over the weekend were those of Marine Colonel William Higgins. Dover Air Force Base Tech Sergeant Larry Orleski says a forensic team will make the final determination.
From there, if they are Colonel Higgins, they'll be transferred to Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland for an honor ceremony.
A group of Shiite Muslims captured Higgins in February 1988 as he commanded a UN peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon. The hostage takers released a videotape purporting to show Higgins hanging from a rope, but U.S. officials believe he died in another manner, perhaps torture. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Wolf, Wilmington.
Reports from the former Soviet Republic of Georgia say that fighting continued for a third day in an uprising against Georgian President Zviad Gamsakhurdia. The news agency TASS said that at least 51 people have been killed in the fighting and 176 have been wounded. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight. We're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone astray.
For Christmas Eve, we decided to spend some time with Tony Bennett by featuring an interview we recorded last summer. This year marked the 40th anniversary of Tony Bennett's first record. Columbia brought out a box set of records that span those 40 years. Some singers lose their touch as they get older, but Bennett is probably a better singer now than he was in the 1950s and 60s when he had all his hits. His voice might have lost some of its power and range, but the years have brought a depth and beauty of phrasing that would be hard to surpass. One turning point in his career was his 1975 album of duets with Bill Evans. With this subtle jazz pianist behind him, instead of gaudy pop arrangements, you could really hear what Bennett could do with a song.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart. How white the ever-constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination. It's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss.
Tony Bennett's first record was Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You almost wouldn't recognize his voice. It was a semi-operatic performance with lots of big, flashy high notes. I asked him if there were opera records around his house when he was growing up.
There really were, because my brother was a magnificent prodigy. He was a very wonderful opera singer. They called him the Little Caruso. He was 13 and sang solo spots in the Metropolitan Opera and did radio shows in those days. That was the highest ratings. The shows were big. And he was always a guest artist on very big radio shows. We all loved opera in my home, and it was during the Depression, and, you know, we'd buy these Caruso records and Gigli, you know, and all these magnificent singers, Richard Tucker, and enjoy the way they sang.
So if your brother was the Little Caruso, what were you?
Well, I was the comedian because I had to compete somehow for all that attention, and I imitated Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor. And did imitations of them, and it used to break my relatives up. Every Sunday, they'd make a circle around my sister, my brother, and myself, and we would entertain them. And we couldn't wait for that Sunday. That was so much fun, and so much love was given to us and encouragement.
Now, your father died when you were 9. How did your mother raise the money, earn the money, to bring up the children?
Well, she was an amazing lady because she was a seamstress, and she worked so hard and raised 3 children. My older sister helped her so much and raised 2 boys, and was, you know, we just were very close and very, well, it was just the most beautiful home life that you could ever dream of. And it was different. It was sad not to have a father and very confusing, but it's funny. It just shows you when people love one another how many things really work out.
How old were you when you had to go out and work for a living?
I was about 15 when I first started. I started out as a singing waiter in the Pheasant Tavern in Astoria, which is now Ricardo's.
So you had to sing in between serving or sing while you were serving?
Well, yeah, both. It was fun. It was almost chaplain-esque, you know, because I had two Irish waiters, and they were great, jolly type guys, and always wanted to encourage me, and I'd get a request to sing I'll Get By or a song like that, and I'd run into the kitchen to get, I know if I sang it, I'd get an extra tip, so they'd teach it to me just right on the spot, and I'd come out singing it, and I used to love doing that, you know, it was just so much fun every weekend when I sang there.
Were you still thinking of yourself as the clown when you were performing then?
No, I just enjoyed. I found out that I've been very fortunate, even before I was known to internationally. I always had luck with audiences. Somehow or other, I always had a gift of communicating, and I got a very nice reaction and encouragement from the audience. So it was always, a positive thing for me to carry on. And I had all kinds of jobs, though. I took all kinds of jobs. I was a runner before computers for the Associated Press. And I'd help the newspaper men get their stories out on the street. And then I was a grocery clerk and an elevator operator. But I really wasn't any good at anything, except I used to have just this craving that I had to become a singer.
Were there any singers in your family? Professional singers.
Well, my brother was a very famous as a young boy. Then he kind of got psyched out by the relatives saying his voice changed at that age, at 15 or 16, and got discouraged about it, unfortunately. But my father, I was told, was a magnificent singer in Italy, that he used to stand on his town in Calabria was in a valley, and he used to sing at the top of the mountain, and the whole town would hear him, and they loved the way he sang. The legend goes.
Did you ever think when you started singing that pop wasn't as important or as serious as opera was?
I made believe it was opera was for snobs, but secretly I just adored it. I still do to this day. I mean, I'm thrilled when I hear a great voice like Pavarotti. I mean, I just know exactly what he's doing, and I have a good ear for hearing good opera, and I know right away if someone is singing well or not in opera, and that's the real thing. I mean, those are the real singers in the world, and I adore them. But I always made believe that the entertainment, I put a lot of wit in it actually, and with what I did, and I just used to just love to sing. I remember very clearly when I was a singing waiter that I said, if nothing ever happens to me, I'd be happy the rest of my life just doing this.
Tony Bennett is my guest, and there's a new Columbia box set called 40 Years, The Artistry of Tony Bennett. That's a compilation of records that spans his entire 40-year recording career. You had an uncle, I think, who was in vaudeville. Did your uncle's stories make you want to go into show business? Did it seem like fun to you?
Well, you know, he was a very wise psychologist, as far as I'm concerned, because his name was Dick Gordon, and Dick Sorace, but his stage name was Dick Gordon, and he was really my father, and I didn't know it. I mean, he would just say, after supper, why don't you come and meet me under the lamppost on the street corner? And he would just hang out and talk to me and tell me these legends, and what an influence he was, because he kind of gave me all the rules and what kind of person I should be if I go into show business. And he warned me that, he said, I don't think you're ever going to make it because you have a rasp in your voice. He said, and if you're a singer, you're not going to make it if you sing. And so it I don't know. He just gave me a fine tuning as to what attitude I should have when I perform and how careful I really have to be about everything.
Well, how did telling you you had a rasp in your voice and therefore you'd never make it as a singer help you?
Well, John Barrymore once said, the harder the slap, the greater the artist.
Were you self-conscious about this thing that your uncle had pointed out to you?
Did absolutely. I mean, I taught how to... Louis Belson, the great drummer, you know, Pearl Bailey's husband, the late Pearl Bailey, he kind of taught me how to breathe and so that when I sing, the rasp is not heard at all. And it's just a matter of breathing before a phrase that you sing, you see.
Now, you were in the military in World War II.
I was in the infantry, yes.
Did you sing with a band during that?
After the war, I joined. There was a fantastic story, you know, about Major Lutkoff, who kind of saved me because a racial prejudice situation jumped off, and it was terrible in my life. And it just changed my life, completely and taught me how to behave to my fellow man because... I went to school with a gentleman called Frank Smith, and he was a wonderful friend, black musician. And he and I used to have so much fun together in New York City. And we had a vocal group at the High School of Industrial Art, where I was studying art. And when I was allowed one guest for Thanksgiving at the Truman Hotel in Mannheim, Germany, after the war was over. And I went to his Baptist church and went to Mass with him, and we had a pleasant time. And I said, "You're allowed to be my guest. Come and have Thanksgiving dinner with me." Well, there was a Southern bigot who was a lieutenant, and he, when I came up out of the restaurant, we were having fun. He came and called me Benedetto. He said, "Come over here." And he took a razor blade and slashed my corporal things off my arm and spit on it and threw it on the floor and sent me to Graves Registration, where you dig up bodies. And it was horrible. And Major Lutkoff saved me. He heard about the incident and took me away from there right away and made me librarian for a wonderful orchestra that was... conducted by Lynn Arison, the warrant officer, and made me the librarian and singer for this beautiful American Forces Network Orchestra.
So as punishment, you were supposed to find the wounded and the dead and bury the dead?
Yes.
How long did you have to do that?
For 2.5 weeks. It was horrible. You know, it was just a horrible thing in my life, and I've never gotten over it. And man's inhumanity of man is very important to me personally.
How do you think you were changed by that experience?
Well, it definitely made me anti-war.
My guest is Tony Bennett. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Tony Bennett is my guest. When you started recording, what was promotion like then? After you had a record out, what were you expected to do to promote the record?
Well, in those days, I started out with a good friend, Rosemary Clooney, and we used to go from town to town, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and get to meet the distributors and the salesmen and the record shops, and we'd go to record shops and sign autographs and... I was the Michael Jackson of my day. You know, we used to have all these teenagers running after me and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Did you have to run to protect
for
yourself
life.
Ever?
Yeah, yeah, that was something. There were so many funny incidents.
Tell me one of them.
One day there was this very stern high school principal in Brooklyn Park there, and there were thousands of girls, and she said, "Now, if you girls don't stay quiet and behave, we're not going to have Mr. Bennett sing for you." And as soon as she said that, they rebelled and broke the barriers. All of a sudden, I had to start running, and it was like a Peter Sellers movie. They were coming at me from all directions. They finally got me in one of those little stone houses, and I was trapped like a rat.
What'd they do to you?
Well, they finally pulled everybody away from me. So it was strange.
So you were intact when you were rescued?
Yeah, I was intact.
No, a lot of the jukeboxes in the 50s when you started recording were, I think, controlled by organized crime.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to deal with that with jukeboxes or getting records played on the radio or anything like that? Or did anyone ever try to put any muscle on you in those early days?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's still going on. It's actually much more severe today.
So what was it like when you were getting started? What impact did organized crime have on you? How did you have to deal with it?
Well, I used to say, they'd say to me, sing Melancholy Baby, and I'd say, well, I don't know that. And they'd say, come to me, my melancholy baby.
So this would be in clubs that would happen?
Yeah, different. Well, not, it wasn't that. It was, you know, everybody had to go through that. In fact, every part of every industry is like that. It's not just the music business. It's every industry.
So, did anyone try to buy a piece of you or anything like that? Did you have to deal with something that...
Oh, yeah,
that
but far? Every artist goes through that. I mean, I read Caruso's life and the same exact thing. I mean, who am I compared to Caruso? I mean, the same thing happened to him. He had to pay, in those days, he had to pay $250,000 to get out of his contract. And that would have been like $2,500,000 right now.
You are really among the most respected singers today, and certainly of your generation. And I mean, among the things you're respected for is not only the beauty of your voice and the depth of your phrasing, but also your repertoire, your choice of songs, your understanding of what makes a song good. In the 50s and 60s, up until around 1965, you had so many records on the charts. You know, you were recording about 3 albums a year, and a lot of the singles were big hits on the charts. Your last chart hit was in 1965, If I Ruled the World. And after that, rock and roll really took off, you know, monopolized the charts pretty much. What were those years in the latter part of the 60s like for you? Were you trying very hard to land something else on the charts, or had
no.
you pretty much given up on
no,
that?
I kind of walked away from it. I thought it was, I saw it as a fiasco. It became more and more Madison Avenue programming, you know, just a marketing thing. I've got this wonderful craving, you know, a friend of mine, John Brasher, he's a dancer, and he said to me, God, you paint every day. He said, why don't you stretch out and make it an occupation? So about 35 years ago, I just took him up on that, and I started painting and going toward selling my paintings and all that and having gallery showings. And then it allowed me to become a performer because I always had deadlines up until then. I had to do, like you say, 3 albums a year and hit singles and all that, and I was really just into the record business, and I just walked away from it. I personally wasn't rejected. I was the one who decided to take a walk, and what happened was very helpful. I learned that things work out for the best because... what happened is I learned how to perform on stage a lot better. Now that I'm recording, my son Danny was responsible for getting a contract where they trust me and I just hand in the record. And thank God for him because it's allowed me the freedom to just express myself freely. And I'm very happy with the recording scene in my personal life right now.
How do you think getting older is changing your voice? And if your voice is changing, how do you think that's changing how you approach a song and how you phrase the lyrics?
Yeah, well, Bobby Hackett taught me to work on bel canto scales every day. And so I've been able to obtain 4 or 5 more notes on the bottom of my register. So now I'm a baritone tenor. And I take good care of my voice and myself.
You are a singer who, it seems to me, keeps getting deeper into songs as you, the longer you sing.
Right.
That your phrasing just seems to become, to have more emotional depth all the time.
You know why that happened? I think I have the answer to that. It's
yeah.
so funny when I used to sit around the house and watch my mom who just made one dress after another, working on a, you know, record-breaking time to make us sew as many dresses as she can, so she'd make a little more money for us to live by. And that every once in a while she would stay very calm and very concentrated on what she was doing, but every once in a while she'd get angered, and she would take a dress and throw it over her shoulder, and she'd say, don't have me work on a bad dress. She said, if you give me a good dress, I don't mind doing this. She said, but don't have me ever work on a bad dress, on a cheap dress. And that's why I've just decided never to compromise. I think that's what it came from. I saw that, you know, she was able to sustain because she stayed with good quality. And I asked Sinatra one time, I said, why do you think that we've sustained so long through the years? He said, that's because we stayed with good songs. So I think when you do something of quality, somehow or other, you may not be on top of the charts, but you're always respected and you always have a place in society by doing something that's made very well.
Tony Bennett. Columbia Records has issued a box set retrospective, but we've gone to his Irving Berlin CD for this recording of White Christmas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. The treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. Of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry and bright. And may all your Christmases be white.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The holiday season is a time for food and wine, for getting together with friends and family. But what do you do if you don't drink, don't cook, don't have kids, and you have to work Christmas Day and New Year's Eve? That's the situation Penn Jillette is in. Penn is the talking half of the magic and comedy team Penn and Teller. We'll find out how he's spending the holidays. If you do have children, you might be considering a trip to see Beauty and the Beast over the holidays. Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Aides to Soviet President Gorbachev say he'll transfer power to Russian President Boris Yeltsin tomorrow. Gorbachev is to announce his resignation in a nationally televised address tomorrow night. Yeltsin's aides say Gorbachev has already given the Russian leader materials needed to control Soviet nuclear weapons. NPR's Tom Jolton reports.
Gorbachev's resignation has been expected for days, though Gorbachev has not yet officially announced his plans. The TASS news agency reported today only that Gorbachev, in his scheduled speech tomorrow night, will announce the decision he made about the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, which is the grouping of republics that's replacing the old Soviet Union. There is little doubt, however, that Gorbachev is on his way out. His aides reported that Gorbachev today said goodbye to his personal staff at the Kremlin. The Soviet Parliament convened today to consider a resolution that the Soviet Union has ceased to exist, but the declaration at this point is superfluous. The 11 former Soviet republics making up the new Commonwealth have already said it. Their prime ministers met today in Moscow to discuss their plans for economic reform and reorganizing the Soviet military. I'm Tom Jolton in Moscow.
The body of what's generally believed to be Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins was returned to the United States today. It was received at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, the traditional destination for deceased soldiers. The widow of Lieutenant Colonel Higgins said she would let her husband's captors be judged by a greater force. Marine Major Robin Higgins said she was willing to wait for that. Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins was one of 8 Westerners known to have died in captivity. There are 3 other captives who are thought to have died while in detention. The body of the Marine officer will be laid to rest this week at Quantico Marine Base in Virginia. The Pentagon today agreed to permit a Christmas airlift of clothing, toys, and food to Haitian refugees at the American military base in Cuba. The effort's organizers say the gifts have been sitting in warehouses for the last 5 days. NPR's Maeve McGoran reports.
The refugees are being held at Guantanamo Bay while American courts decide whether to allow them into this country or send them back to Haiti. A number of New York politicians, including Governor Mario Cuomo, U.S. Congressman Charles Rangel, and New York City Mayor David Dinkins, have protested the Pentagon's delay in approving the Christmas airlift. Today, Rangel said Defense Secretary Richard Cheney has told him the flight will be allowed.
There was no reason why they could not have granted authority for this many days ago. But I don't know what the thinking is. It was a political decision.
Hearings on whether or not the Haitians will be repatriated are scheduled for a Miami federal appeals court Monday. I'm Maeve McGoran in New York.
The stock market closed early today because of the Christmas holiday, but the Dow gained more than 28 points to end the day at 3050.90. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Authorities say they have everything under control at the scene of a multi-car train derailment near Spokane, Washington. Warren Harshbarger of member station KPBX has details.
The derailment sent at least 2 train cars crashing onto Interstate 90, and 1 car is reportedly still hanging above the trestle. The Washington State Patrol Office in Spokane says a Greyhound bus sustained slight damage when it was grazed by one of the falling cars. The bus continued onward. Interstate 90 westbound has been closed for an undetermined amount of time. The Burlington Northern train derailed at 4:15 this morning Pacific time. The State Patrol says there are no reports of injuries or hazardous substances. This is the second Burlington Northern derailment in 2 days. A tanker car that caught fire yesterday following a derailment north of Seattle is still burning. Authorities say they're just waiting for the car to burn itself out. For National Public Radio, this is Warren Harshbarger in Spokane, Washington.
The Journal of the American Medical Association today released a report that said women with breast cancer may get substandard care at small urban hospitals that treat poorly insured patients. The AMA study looked at 99 Illinois hospitals that treated nearly 84% of the estimated new breast cancer cases in the state during 1988. Overall, more than 40% of those women didn't receive two therapies considered appropriate for breast cancer care at small Chicago hospitals. But women got the best care at larger hospitals outside the city that treated well-insured patients. The study researchers say the report provides statistics for what physicians have long suspected. 1 in 9 American women will get breast cancer. A union spokeswoman says machinists for United Airlines have overwhelmingly approved a new 5-year labor contract with the carrier. The contract was approved late yesterday by 80% of those voting. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Christmas Eve is a time for tradition, but not for everyone. We called Penn Jillette to see if he had anything unconventional up his sleeve for the holiday. Penn Jillette is the talking half of the magic and comedy team Penn and Teller. He's got Christmas Eve off, but tomorrow it's back to the John Houseman Theater in New York, where Penn and Teller are performing their Rot in Hell show. They'll be working New Year's Eve, too, hosting Fox TV's live broadcast from Times Square. But what about tonight? How is the irreverent Penn Jillette spending Christmas Eve?
I don't think I have any special plans. Talking about the holidays to an atheist teetotaler without children is, I've never had a drink in my life or any drug, so that's kind of out of the question. I'm a very strong atheist and a skeptic, so, you know, church is kind of out of there. And if I were to be raising children, I think there'd be a lot of fun and, like, opening presents and stuff. But for me, it's just, it is a rare evening off. So I'll probably sit around. I might even eat. Although on Thanksgiving, I want to tell people this. For a wealthy person who doesn't cook, Thanksgiving is the easiest day in the world to starve to death.
All the restaurants are closed.
Yeah. Thanksgiving Day, I decided to stay home and try to do some writing on our book. So I woke up, and then I decided, well, not to have breakfast. I just have lunch late. And I got to really typing and working, and I worked till about 3 or 4, and then decided to hit the mean streets in New York. And I live right upstairs from, like, two diners, which are both closed. And the Chinese restaurant down the street was closed. And then I was walking around kind of aimlessly. So I came back home, and it got to be evening, and all I'd eaten then was a bowl of cereal. So I decided that I would call and get food delivered, and I called 7 Chinese restaurants and 4 pizza places, and they were all closed.
So Penn, as an atheist and a skeptic, do you get irritated around the holiday season?
Oh, absolutely not. It doesn't bother me at all. I think it's a really nice, sweet, pretty harmless holiday. What bothers me, the teetotaler side of myself gets more upset because my first, my second or third job in high school was I worked in a hospital in dietary, which means I was a dishwasher. But on New Year's Eve, most of the people wanted to take time off. So since I didn't drink and didn't go to parties, I decided to pull that shift. And I was the guy in charge of bringing sandwiches to the ER people, the emergency room people, on New Year's Eve. And it just became, in my mind, the symbol of New Year's Eve. So I won't drive on New Year's Eve. Wherever Penn and Teller work on New Year's Eve, it says in our contract that I have to be able to sleep there.
Oh, wow.
Or I have to be able to walk, because I just have this really, and I think partially irrational fear, that it just seems to make such ironic sense that I, who've never had a drink in my life, would die from a drunk driver on New Year's Eve. And I'm very encouraged by how we've improved drunk driving on New Year's Eve in this country. We have tremendously. But on New Year's Eve this year, I will be in Times Square, but I'll be high over it, and then they've got me a room there, so I'll just stay there overnight.
You're working this New Year's Eve.
Yes, I am. As my father says, if you're not working New Year's Eve, you're not in show business. But we're doing one show at 7 o'clock at our theater for Rotten Hell, Penn & Teller Rotten Hell, on 42nd Street. Then we go right from there over to do Fox from 11 to 12:30. We're on Fox nationally, on, one of these things that they'll probably end up calling, Rockin' New Year's something, We've got Guns N' Roses and Sam Kennison on tape, and we're live with Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. And the only reason I'm doing this is that this is the first year Fox is trying this with us, and they've made it clear that if we do well, we'll be able to do it next year. Now, who gives a damn about next year? Nobody. But if we do it well next year, then we can do it the next year. Who cares about next year? Nobody. But if we do it well, we can do it the next year. Who cares about that year? Nobody. If we do it well, we can do it the next year. Who cares? Nobody. Next year, who cares? Nobody. Next year is, people think it's the millennium, it'll be the year 2000. Then we can go on and make fun of it because it's not the millennium, it's 2001. But then 2001, we can be ushering in the millennium from Times Square. So that's my long-range plan.
Listen, if you've got to have a goal, I think that's a very
that's
good one.
That's my goal in life. Wouldn't you like to see Penn and Teller high over Times Square when the millennium changes for you?
Yeah, I'll vote for that. Did you used to stay home and watch Guy Lombardo?
What's that?
Did you used to stay home and watch Guy Lombardo?
My mom and dad, yeah. See, I didn't even know. I mean, this is how sheltered I was. I didn't even know that drinking was a big part of New Year's Eve growing up. I thought it was the day that you pulled out like 2 half gallons of butter pecan ice cream and watched TV. I always thought that that was the tradition until I was like, you know, 12 or 13, because that's what my parents always did. They never went out. You know, they just watched TV and ate ice cream and gave really puritanical little kisses at the strike of midnight, you know?
So how sheltered were you exactly?
Oh, tremendously. My mom and dad are generations and generations of teetotalers and not very party-like and don't raise their voices and don't hit. And, you know, so the whole idea, I mean, my whole love of theatrical violence is exactly the same as Arthur Penn's. I, too, have never hit anyone in my life, nor has Teller. I mean, I've never been in a fight. I've been hit, but then the fights end because they're sick of it if you don't hit back, at least the people that I was fortunate enough to have been trying to fight with me. So yes, tremendously. I mean, it's a joke. When friends of mine meet my parents, it's because Teller and I, you know, do theatrical violence, and because I'm very aggressive and loud and outspoken in the show, people kind of expect me to have some sort of modern family. But I was born when my mom was 45 years old. So I was raised by older parents in a small New England town like Hooterville out of Green Acres or something, and raised with, you know, none of the stuff that's so popular to talk about nowadays. I didn't have any of that, you know, home cooked meals every night, and, you know, if you nurture your children properly, they'll grow up to be like me. That's the nightmare.
But Penn, if you came from such a sheltered family, I bet they observed Christmas. What was Christmas like for you when you were growing
Christmas
up?
Christmas was always great. See, I think when you're a kid, it's just a wonderful thing. We always had, my dad was a jail guard, had to work Christmas Day on early shifts. We always had Christmas Christmas Eve. And, you know, my sister, who is 23 years older than me, which I think answers a lot of questions. I mean, are you really planning on having your children 23 years apart? I don't think I was planned. We're the only two kids. We'd go over to my sister's house, you know, who was already married when I was like 2, and you know, have a nice dinner, and then come back, and, you know, Santa Claus would have come when I was over my sister's, and we'd all be have a tree and the very traditional Christmas. I think it's terrific for kids and stuff. It seems like a really wonderful, sweet holiday for children.
My guest is Penn Jillette of the magic and comedy team Penn and Teller. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the holidays with Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller. Listen, on the holidays when you're not doing what one is supposed to do, like on the Thanksgiving when you're working and then you're looking for a restaurant or someplace to deliver a pizza, or on Christmas Eve when you're not celebrating by a tree and the fireplace and the whole bit, although you don't want to be participating in that in the first place, you still feel like, ooh, gee, maybe I'm really missing out on something.
I never have felt that. I always, I call my mom and dad. I mean, this is really pathetic. I mean, if you want to have a rock and roll image, I call my mom and dad nearly every day. At least 5 or 6 days a week, I call them. But on Christmas and New Year's, and Christmas Eve and so on, I often call them a couple, 3 times, you know, during their dinner and stuff. Because if I could be home and see my mom and dad, I would really like that because of how much they'd like it. But I have a show tomorrow, and I went back to see my mom and dad last week. So we kind of had a turkey dinner and stuff and kind of faked it then. But I don't really miss any of it. I really like, except for not being able to deliver pizza, I really like the peacefulness, that it's a time that you can kind of be home alone without being bugged, you know?
Do you ever like to go to the movies Christmas Day? Because the movie theaters are often empty and really comfortable.
Is that true? I found just the opposite.
Well, Christmas Eve is actually what I'm thinking. Christmas Eve, they're always really empty.
It's Christmas Day later in the day. Like last year, I went to see Godfather.
Me too.
In Hollywood.
Not in Hollywood, but I went to see it in Philadelphia, and the theater was jammed.
Packed, absolutely packed. And then I don't remember what I saw. I usually do, but this year, of course, I've already seen Bugsy and JFK, so... I don't know what my... did you see JFK yet?
No, I haven't seen either of them yet.
Wow, JFK. Wow, just making stuff up.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing. And the most frightening thing is, and this is the only thing that terrifies me about free speech, is that I actually, a woman said to me last night, well, he couldn't put that stuff in a movie if it wasn't true.
Right, right, right.
Someone actually said that.
Yeah.
And see... to have Oliver Stone be able to say that is terrific and wonderful, as long as there are plenty of people like Tom Wicker and Newsweek and stuff pointing out the mistakes.
Well, I want to get back to this Times Square thing that you're doing on Fox TV New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
When I was young and before I was old enough to go out on New Year's Eve, the only special program was the Guy Lombardo show.
Yeah.
And it was just the squarest show imaginable.
He was Canadian, you know.
Well, I didn't mean that as a slur against... our brothers and sisters to the north. But I'm wondering if you're planning anything that's a kind of a comment on the kind of New Year's Eve shows that you used to watch when you were young.
We've been fighting desperately with Fox, who has control of the ball, to try to bribe and cheat people into dropping the ball at a different time. And I actually think we've made some progress. to actually try to change it a minute. And from the moment we took this on, it's been our only goal. So I just think it would be terrific for those who have seen some of the stuff we've done in the past to be able to tune in New Year's Eve and say, you know, what would Penn and Teller do? And I think the only choice is to drop the ball at a different time. And so we're working on that. And boy, is it complicated.
Well,
there are a lot of people who that's really important that it goes at midnight, you know?
So this is going to be the Times Square ball, or are they setting up a separate Fox ball?
No, it'll be the Times Square ball.
How do you like working on holidays when everybody else is supposed to be partying?
I just really love it. Because otherwise, like I said, you can't eat. You know, it's really hard, and it just seems like what I should be doing. I mean, I'm the perfect person to be working New Year's Eve. You know, I want to be sober. I don't have anything else I want to be doing. What better person could you have to lead the festivities?
You know, you're not big on holiday traditions, but you have some traditions of your own, don't you, that you've made up in the recent years?
Well, we have movie night.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always movie night, which is every Friday night in Times Square. We all get together and go to Howard Johnson's and then go to a movie at midnight. And that's been going on since, I guess it's like 7 years now. Something like that every Friday, and there's a bunch of people that do it. It's been heavily it kind of shifts in who comes, because we never invite anybody, we never throw anybody out, and it stays around 30 people. But lately, it's been heavily Bell Labs. For some reason, Bell Labs in New Jersey. We've got like 5 guys that come in, so the talk has lately turned from showbiz to science and patents and software and stuff.
Did you see JFK on a Friday night with us?
No, I didn't. It would have been a great, great movie night movie, because one of the rules of movie night is that you do polite, quiet cocktail party gloved applause every time they say the name of the movie within the movie. So JFK is a good one for that.
You'd be applauding through the whole film.
Well, no, not as much. The nightmare was the movie Dad. I mean, we came out with our heads bloodied, you know.
So what did you see last Friday?
Last Friday was Bugsy.
Oh.
And they luckily, in the movie, Ben Siegel does not like being called Bugsy. Anyone who calls him that gets punched. So it only happens like 3 times in the movie. So that's a nice right amount for a movie night.
On your New Year's Eve special, will you be counting down? Will you be the person doing the countdown?
I believe I will. And that's why we're fighting so hard to get it to go off at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope we can do it. I would think it would be a nifty thing. How much would you like to see that ball go at like 11:59?
Well, I think that's very subversive. I like it. I like it.
I think we may be able to pull it off. Actually, we haven't hit a no yet, so.
Well, Penn, I suppose I should let you go and start phoning around seeing if there's any restaurants open tonight.
Yeah, I've got to eat something.
Well, have a good holiday. And have fun New Year's Eve.
I will.
Yeah. So thanks for talking with
okay.
us. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Penn Jillette of the magic and comedy team Penn and Teller. They're performing through January 19th at the John Houseman Theater in New York.
You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's gonna find out who's naughty or nice.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight, closing up shop in Moscow. That process is moving fast. A story from NPR's Tom Jelton. Blaine Harden of the Washington Post gives us a Christmas Eve assessment of a somewhat bleak situation in Yugoslavia and warns of explosive tensions in the Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Also, we'll listen in on world-class ice skaters training in Montana.
Anything for Christmas Eve?
Well, we have a conversation and some music. The conversation's with Paddy Maloney of the Chieftains about the new album, The Bells of Dublin. We'll hear some music from Kate and Anna McGarrigle, Marianne Faithfull, Elvis Costello, and others, and a great recording of the actual Bells of Dublin themselves.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Bookshop. I just finished the most wonderful story about a beanstalk and an ogre and
that's
a...
That's nice. Marie! The baguettes! Hurry up!
Look, there she goes. That girl is strange, no question. Dazed and distracted, can't you tell?
Never part of any crowd.
Cause her head's a lonesome cloud.
No denying she's a funny girl, that bell.
Bonjour.
Good day.
How is your fam?
Unlike her animated predecessors, Belle, the heroine of the new movie Beauty and the Beast, is cast as a feminist. So critic Maureen Corrigan had to go see the film.
The Disney studios have created all sorts of strange creatures over the last 50 years. A talking mouse, a flying elephant, a rabbit that ice skates. But they've never conjured up a feminist before, so I was intrigued. Well, Belle is no Thelma or Louise. But she is smart and brave. She prefers reading books to mooning about, waiting for her prince to come. And when her father and then her beloved beast are in danger, she sets out alone to rescue them. I think Disney's responding to critics who've objected to the female stereotyping in other classic cartoons. Before Belle, the only gutsy female character that Disney ever created was Dumbo's mother. But the real twist in Beauty and the Beast is its treatment of male characters. Someone at Disney must have gone on a wild man weekend. the movie comes across like a dramatization of one of those men's movement Bibles, Iron John or Fire in the Belly. The traditional French fairy tale of Beauty and the Beast focuses on how Beauty learns to love the Beast despite his fur. And the TV show of a few seasons back took the same approach. But the center of Disney's story is the Beast's evolution into a strong and sensitive new man. To drive home its message about masculinity, the movie shows us two other men who don't quite meet the Iron John standard. There's Beauty's father, Maurice, an inventor, all brain and no brawn. And then there's Gaston. He looks like Prince Charming, but he's exposed as a reactionary who sees women as sex objects and who only loves himself.
No one fights like Gaston, does his life like Gaston.
In a wrestling match, nobody fights like Gaston.
For there's no one as curly and brawny.
As you see, I've got biceps to spare.
Not a bit of him scraggly or scrawny.
That's right, and every last inch of me's covered with hair.
No one hits like Gaston.
With Beauty's help, the Beast combines Gaston's macho-ness with Maurice's compassion. By movie's end, the Beast has changed into a new man named Eric. And to show Beauty that he loves her mind as well as her looks, he gives her a magnificent library. I admit, I did feel disappointed when the Beast and all of the enchanted objects in his castle become human again. Nobody breathes life into animals, vegetables, and household appliances better than Disney. This movie, like its predecessors, is filled with wonders. A teapot with the voice of Angela Lansbury, a candelabra that dances and sings like Maurice Chevalier. Because Disney's movies are so magical, criticizing their sexual politics has always seemed like such a drippy thing to do. That's why Beauty and the Beast is such a treasure. Children of all ages can fall under its spell without worrying about swallowing warped romantic fantasies. Beauty and the Beast both become stronger after they fall in love. Okay, it's a fairy tale, but like Tinkerbell says, you gotta believe.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Roberta Sherrock, Joan Tui, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross. Happy holiday.
Be our guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot hors d'oeuvre. Why, we only live to serve. Try the gray stuff. It's delicious. Don't believe me? Ask the dishes. They can sing, they can dance. After all, miss, this is France. And a dinner here is never second best. Go on, unfold your menu, take a glance, and then you'll be our guest. We our guest, be our guest.
Beef ragout, cheese souffle, pie and pudding
on flambé. We'll prepare and serve with flair a culinary cabaret. You're alone and you're scared, but the banquet's all prepared.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, A Charlie Brown Christmas, we talk with the creator of Charlie Brown and the rest of the cast of Peanuts, cartoonist Charles Schulz. Also, singer Leslie Gore tells us what she's been up to since she hit number one back in the 60s with It's My Party. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.